Hello and welcome back to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I'm an oral maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado, and I really appreciate you tuning into the episode today. Thanks to all those who have emailed and texted me ideas about topics for the podcast or guests they want to hear from. If you would like to be a guest on the show or know someone you'd like to hear from, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Also, please visit our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, if you'd like to search the podcast in an easier way by topic. We'd like to hear from everyone and really appreciate you guys listening. Keep in mind that everything we're discussing here is based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement everything you're learning here with approved research studies. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Hey guys, before we start the episode, I want to give you a heads up on something super cool going on. As many of you know, I talk a lot about the instruments I use on the podcast, and I've tried instruments from many different suppliers, and by far I've found that KLS Martin provides the best oral surgery extraction instruments. So I recently spoke with KLS Martin about the podcast, and they agreed to offer a real amazing promotional code to our listeners. So if you guys use the code capital EOSE lowercase XO 22 between now and the end of the year of 2022, you'll receive 40% off any instruments that are part of the basic extraction tray that KLS provides. This includes almost any instrument you'd kind of want in your routine extraction tray, including elevators, mouth props, and the main extraction forceps like the upper and lower universal. So I will post a list of the instruments that this code will cover on our website. You can also email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com if you want that list emailed to you. This is a super legit deal. I love these instruments. Can't tell you how excited I am about using this myself. I'm constantly, you know, needing more instruments and using KLS to provide more stuff for me. So super cool. Appreciate those guys for doing this for our listeners, and feel free to enjoy. Thank you. All right. Welcome to another episode. Thank everyone for joining in and listening in today. Today I'm with Dr. Ben Heckler. He's an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in North Carolina. Ben, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast again.
Thanks again, Grant. Happy to be here.
Yes. We've talked about several topics. I've gotten a lot of good feedback from different listeners about how helpful it's been. So glad to have you back and talk to you about another topic. We've talked to a couple guests in the past kind of about their philosophy on treating TMD and stuff like that. But I thought, you know, we were talking at a prior conversation, I thought it'd be good to kind of run through TMJ surgery and TMD and talk to you about your philosophy. And then maybe we'll go in a little more intricate kind of treatment type stuff that could be helpful potentially for those treating TMD and also those taking board exams, stuff like that. So with all that, can you just kind of start off by telling us, you know, let's say we have a patient who comes into the office who has complaints of jaw pain and they're referred to you for a TMJ consult. Where do you go with that and how do you diagnose the issue?
Yeah, I think the key to starting, because you're right, they all start with jaw pain or jaw issue or limited mouth opening. And many times the referral is very vague and you truly don't know if you're dealing with a TMJ problem or a myofascial problem or really something that has nothing to do with the jaw as far as neuropathic issues or fibromyalgia. So I think having a standardized way that you work these patients up is really helpful. And that has helped me to kind of navigate which patients I don't need to be treating and which patients I'm not going to help versus those that I'll be able to help either with conservative management and or surgery. So I think one reference that I'll just throw out right off the bat that's been really helpful to me has been the updated guidelines from what's called the DCTMD, the Diagnostic Criteria for Temporomandibular Joint Disorders. And I think it was 2014 when the most recent one was put out. And it basically lays out, I think, about 10 diagnoses that are included within TMD. And these are things like myalgia, myofascial pain with referral, myofascial pain without referral, the different types of internal derangements, so anterior disc displacement with reduction, without, with intermittent locking, and then other things as well, such as subluxation, headaches attributed to TMD, things like this. And that's been really helpful to me, because if patients don't fit in these categories, if they're having pain that's not consistent with these diagnoses, well, I'm probably not going to help them as an oral and maxillofacial surgeon with conservative or surgical management. So right off the bat, and I won't go into huge detail yet because I know we'll be talking about these, I think having a standardized way that you examine these patients is key. And we can talk about the specifics as far as how I do that now or in the future. But if you don't have a standardized way and you're just kind of going based upon what the chief complaint is and treating these patients differently day by day, you're going to get lost as far as, is this a TMJ, TMD patient or is it not?
Yep. All right. Can you run us through kind of your systematic way of evaluating these patients?
Yeah. So everything starts with the subjective. So when these patients come in, you want to hear their chief complaint, just like you said. And you want to give these patients a lot of time, these TMJ patients, because typically these patients have had this problem or a similar problem for a long time. And yes, some of the information they're giving you may not be relevant, but many times these patients say, you know, 10 years ago, or when I was 14, or it's not typical, and it does occur, but it's not typical that they say, hey, last week this happened, and that's why I'm coming to see you. So you got to give them some time. The things I ask about specifically in the HPI for the TMJ is, of course, you want to ask all the things about pain, where it's located, when it started, the frequency, the intensity, the characteristics, etc. But you also want to ask about things that can affect the joint and the muscles of mastication, so previous trauma. Did they also have a history personally or a family history of a systemic arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or does anyone in their family have those type of diseases? Do they have other things that are contributing factors? Do they have psychiatric diagnoses? Do they have musculoskeletal or neuromuscular problems? Do they have tics, things of that nature? Because as we know, a lot of these repetitive motions, micro traumas, or of course, macro traumas, history of actual facial trauma can lead to these. Medications come into play too. Many of us know that SSRIs and SNRIs are attributed to bruxism. So having a good HPI as far as the different factors are really key. And you know, there are many other things that I haven't mentioned yet, but those are a few of the things that I try to understand right off the bat. The examination, I think, is also very, very helpful too in delineating these causes that are within the joint, so capsular problems or intracapsular problems versus myofascial pain problems. So what I do, and again, this is based upon these new DCTMD recommendations, is I start by palpating the joints on both sides, so preauricularly, both superficially and deeply. So superficially, I have the patient stay closed and I palpate the lateral pole of the condyle. If you read these guidelines, they will tell you to palpate with 1 kilogram of pressure. Now, first of all, it's a little confusing what 1 kilogram is. I mean, it's 2.2 pounds. But secondly, kilograms isn't pressure. That's a weight. Pressure is, you know, kilograms per square centimeters or something. But it's not very hard that you're pushing is the point. So you push on the lateral pole and ask if they have pain and score it 0 out of 10. And then I have them open and I push behind the condyle. There's a little concavity that forms when you have them open, and ask them again. And that's my deep reading. Now, what we used to do is we used to palpate through the external auditory canal, but they actually don't recommend doing that anymore in these new guidelines because it's not very reproducible. So I do superficial and deep palpation on the condyle both sides. And then I start to palpate the muscles. Again, these new DCTMD guidelines say you really only need to palpate the temporalis and masseter muscles because, again, the medial pterygoids, the lateral pterygoids, the temporalis tendon intraorally, those were all found to be not very reproducible. And so I palpate the muscle again with 2.2 pounds, 1 kilogram of force, and ask for a score 0 out of 10. And I ask patients if they have pain just where I'm pressing on the muscle or if it radiates throughout that muscle or refers elsewhere. And this goes back to the myofascial pain and myofascial pain with referral versus just local myalgia or trigger points. And then when I look intraorally, you, of course, want to do your normal range of motion, mouth opening, particularly if there's deviation on opening. And then all your excursive movements, your protrusion, your lateral excursions. And then I think looking for signs of bruxism or clenching, you know, looking for fractured teeth, attrition, linea alba, scalloped tongue, all those things are really helpful. That's kind of the basic examination. And there are many other things that some of us do based upon findings. But I think if you include those in your basic report, you can do, you know, a satisfactory baseline temporomandibular joint evaluation and examination.
What are the findings from your exam that are going to tell you this is extracapsular and or this is going to be intracapsular? Like, what is going to be in each column and how are you going to decide that?
Yeah, one of the biggest things that's going to tell you if this is intracapsular is going to be if there's jaw deviation that is reproducible. So if the patient, when they open, has a maximum incisal opening of any number, but reproducibly deviates to one side, then that typically means that the patient has something like anterior disc displacement without reduction on the side of deviation. So a patient that opens, deviates to the left, they very likely have an intracapsular problem, internal derangement on that side. Now, it may be something else. They could have anchored disc phenomenon. They could have pseudodiscal adaptation that's occurred, and it may be a different degree of mouth opening. But if they're deviating to one side, almost always that indicates an intracapsular problem on that side. It could also indicate some type of ankylosis on that side. But the point being, there is not a normal rotation and translation occurring on that side. Extracapsular problems many times are associated with significant myofascial or myalgic pain. Sometimes too, in some of these issues that are not related to the jaw joint at all, you're going to actually be palpating things too that are abnormal. So, you know, let's say something as abnormal as myositis ossificans, which is a process where some of the muscles actually start to have calcifications in them. Well, you may feel a master muscle that feels rock hard. And if that's the case, okay, well, we understand that something is probably going on outside of the capsule. But in combination with pain that is usually preauricular, so that's superficial or deep, and jaw deviation, those two things are going to tell me that this is probably at least partially a capsular problem versus if there's very minimal preauricular pain and the range of motion is pretty symmetric, then we're very likely dealing with at least a component that's primarily myofascial.
Got it. So you said if it's deviating to the left, that would be kind of a disc that's not reducing and getting into the right place. It's just kind of stuck in front and the condyle's getting stuck on it and it's swinging to that direction. For things that are reducing, is it just clicking and popping but no deviation or what's that?
Usually, yes. And the other thing that you could notice is if you look very closely, again, let's say a patient has a left anterior disc displacement with reduction. Number one, you may audibly hear a pop when they open. You may also hear it with a stethoscope. I do routinely auscultate the joint as well. But another thing that you can see on exam if you look very closely is that when they open, there may be a very early deviation towards that side, and then it goes back to midline. And that's just because, of course, the disc on that side is capturing just a little bit late, whereas on the contralateral side, you already have a normal disc position. So the first 5 to 10 millimeters of opening, you see a little bit of deviation to the right, and then it comes back to midline for the rest of opening. That would be consistent with anterior disc displacement with reduction.
Got it. Okay. All right. And so which patients are going to kind of be escalated to the next level, you know, of surgery? Who's going to fit that category for you to say, yeah, you could benefit from surgery?
I think you'll get a lot of different answers from different surgeons for this. But let me tell you the way I conceptualize this. And again, some people will probably disagree with me and some will agree. But this is how I do things based upon, you know, my understanding of what's been helpful. So first of all, if patients have a new problem and they've not been evaluated by anybody for this problem before, I think it's always reasonable to consider some conservative measures unless their examination is quite severe. I mean, if someone comes in to see you and they can't open and you get a pano and they're ankylosed, obviously we're not going to do conservative measures for that. But the majority of patients come in with some history of popping and or pain and or difficulty with function. And if they haven't been treated with conservative measures, I think that's reasonable. And those measures that can be implemented pretty much for everybody would be things such as a short course of a soft diet, You can use, of course, NSAIDs and anti-inflammatory medications if this was an acute event, if they had, you know, an episode of biting into something hard and then they had pain and limited opening over the next number of weeks. You can use muscle relaxants if there's a myofascial or myalgic component, which usually there is. And you can, of course, always use things such as occlusal splints. And those are helpful, you know, for patients that don't have TMD, but also have clenching and bruxism as well. Some people will use that for a very long period of time. And, you know, there are oral facial pain specialists and dentists in the community that will do conservative management for 3 to 6 months. And you know, we'll say we can't refer you for further care unless this fails. But many of us who treat these patients frequently, if we see them and they fit into one of these categories where we say, oh, we're probably going towards a procedure, many of us have a lower threshold to do something. And that something is usually arthrocentesis or arthroscopy early on. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that early arthrocentesis with or without arthroscopy in patients that have internal derangement is very beneficial. So for me, when a patient comes in to see me, I guess I should say, first of all, I restrict my referrals to patients who have usually seen someone for their problem before me. I don't accept referrals from a primary care physician for possible TMD, quite frankly, because I don't think they know what they're talking about. And I want them to see a dentist first. But if a patient sees me, which means they've seen a dentist or someone else that knows what they're talking about, and they have a presentation consistent with internal derangement and pain, so deviation on opening, pre-auricular pain and or post-auricular pain, limited function, problems with eating, they've tried some things conservatively and it's not really having any good benefit, I will have an extraordinarily low threshold to perform an arthrocentesis. And I don't get three-dimensional imaging before doing that, because regardless of what the three-dimensional imaging shows, again, unless on a screening panoramic, they're ankylosed or something, usually arthrocentesis is beneficial in those cases. Again, patients that come in and clearly have a worse problem, they have a giant tissue mass around the TMJ. Like I said, they're ankylosed on a pano, or they have a fracture or something like that. That's a different story. But for the run-of-the-mill TMD patient that comes in and has tried a couple of things or has seen a dentist before, I think early use of arthrocentesis and or arthroscopy can be very beneficial for these patients.
As far as the thought process of what's going on with arthrocentesis, you know, because we assume there's been some adverse loading in the joint. There's, you know, free radicals causing inflammation and breakdown of stuff. And there's that, you know, theory of like the sticky disc or sticky joint. And so you get in there, you flush it out, flush out those inflammatory mediators, sometimes, you know, plus or minus steroids. The theory is that's supposed to kind of what renew the joint and get out all that inflammation and bad stuff going on. Can you just talk about that and then like long-term what you can really expect to happen after an arthrocentesis?
Sure. So you're exactly right. You know, the whole idea as to why we do this is to flush out inflammatory mediators, to break up small microadhesions, and then it allows us to inject medications if we wish to as well. And you mentioned steroids, you know, other things that can be injected are lubricants like hyaluronic acid, PRP, local anesthetics, and things like that. You know, in general, arthrocentesis works very, very well for all different types of internal derangements and other things like joint effusions. So what can you expect? You know, what's your question with this? Well, I tell most patients that you're going to have a positive experience after arthrocentesis. If you look, the vast majority of studies show that for the vast majority of patients, almost regardless of the reason for doing it, they're going to have improvement of pain and function. Now, the one thing I do give as a disclaimer for patients, and it depends upon their presentation and really on their duration of symptoms too, is that they may have benefit from it very early on. And those are patients that had an acute episode. So they had an acute anchored disc phenomenon, the sticky disc you were talking about, or acute anterior disc displacement without reduction, or an acute joint effusion. If I've caught this early, I can tell them, hey, very shortly after arthrocentesis, like that day or that week, you're going to feel a lot better. But if patients have a very long history of chronic internal derangement, maybe they have anterior disc displacement without reduction that's been going on for years, and now they have some pseudodiscal adaptation where they can open a little bit better, but it's still painful and they still deviate, those patients, I typically tell it's going to take a number of months for you to actually get to the location that we think you've achieved benefit, being increased mouth opening and improved pain. I think in those cases, some of the adjunctive physiotherapy after arthrocentesis can be really beneficial. But I love the patients that come in the door that have had an acute problem, like in the last month or two, because those are the patients that you have a really good result early on, and they're really appreciative of it, because you catch them before all this scarring and all this altered anatomy has occurred, and you can pretty much get them back to normal very quickly.
Nice. And I would assume, because arthrocentesis is just flushing out inflammation, but it's not, you know, really addressing why did this actually happen and start? Because if it is from adverse loading and clenching and grinding and bruxing, I mean, that has to be resolved as well, right? Or else they'll be back with continued problems. Or what do you do to try to long-term stop problems?
You sound like my patients, Grant. You're asking me all the questions I don't want to answer. I just want to do the procedure and go home.
Exactly.
But no, you're exactly right. And that's what intelligent patients will ask you. They'll say, well, wait a second, that we're just treating this, but like, why did this happen? Is this going to happen again? It's tricky. TMD in general is a multifactorial disease process. And in many cases, in fact, I'd say the majority of cases, there's no one reason that this happened to this patient. Now, we know certain patients are at higher risk of this. We know women are at higher risk of this. We know people that are anxiety prone or have diagnoses of psychiatric conditions are at risk for this, or other reasons that, as you mentioned, they're overloading the joint, medications, et cetera. So what I typically do, and this is why, like I told you, when patients come to see me, I restrict my referrals to patients who have already seen a dentist or a similar provider, like an orofacial pain provider, before they see me, because I absolutely say, hey, after we do the arthrocentesis, I'm going to introduce you to some physiotherapy that I'd like you to do, but we still need to go back to this risk factor modification and conservative management. And many times it's an occlusal appliance to help offload the joint, particularly in the evening times. Sometimes, again, it's medication management. And that's why I like working with oral facial pain providers, because they're really good at doing that. And other times, quite frankly, in addition to physiotherapy, I mean, it's psychiatric management, it's cognitive behavioral therapy, or working with some of their other chronic illnesses. And I know that sounds silly, and particularly from a surgeon's perspective, we don't want to say, oh, we're going to be doing medication management or referring someone for orofacial pain or medication management. But in the majority of these patients, it's not like they have one thing that you just need to turn the switch on or off and their TMD will disappear. It's kind of this chronic decades old loading of the joint and stress and, you know, micro damage, micro trauma that then you're trying to manage and then trying to get back as best you can to normal. It's kind of like from other chronic illnesses, some of the disease that's already been done, how do we manage it? I mean, think about type 2 diabetes, you get neuropathies, you get small vessel damage. Well, we can't reverse that, but we have to address what's causing it in addition to trying to treat the damage that we currently have. So the bottom line is, you can't just do an arthrocentesis and say, we'll do these jaw exercises, I'll see you in 3 months. That's not going to work. And that's why, personally for me, I like them plugged in with another dental provider or oral facial pain provider who's already on board.
Okay, that's helpful to hear. This is my experience as well. So let's keep going down the algorithm here. So somebody who comes back after whatever X amount of months after an arthrocentesis and still having the, you know, issues, pain, maybe they're having closed lock again. Well, what's next for that patient?
Well, this never happens in my practice, Grant. my patients always do perfectly. So
Right.
We'll pretend I have no idea about this. You're right. This happens, unfortunately, pretty commonly. This scenario, because it's so common, this is exactly what I do in these cases. So this patient's already been treated with conservative management. This patient's undergone an arthrocentesis. They've presumably done the physiotherapy and the other conservative things after arthrocentesis, and they're still having the same symptoms, or the symptoms got better and now they're worsening, or something else has come up. This is when I move on to TMJ MRIs. And for a couple of reasons. One is because, again, like I said before, the TMJ MRI up front, assuming the run-of-the-mill patient that's, again, not ankylosed, doesn't have like a tumor, that MRI doesn't affect my arthrocentesis decision up front. But now, it's very helpful to determine if this patient needs further intervention, namely surgical intervention. And also from an insurance standpoint, most insurance companies aren't going to approve a TMJ MRI right off the bat unless you've tried conservative therapy and particularly arthrocentesis. So at that point, I, at least in my experience, have not had issues with getting TMJ MRIs approved at that juncture. And when I do TMJ MRIs, and I think most of us do the same thing, there's a couple ways that you can order them. So for the typical TMJ osteoarthritis internal derangement patient, you get this without contrast. You don't need it. You get a TMJ MRI, and I ask for at minimum T1 and T2 sequences in open and closed mouth positions. Now, it's nice to get proton density sequences too, PD sequences. It shows the disc anatomy really, really well. The only patients that I get TMJ MRIs with and without contrast, so contrast as well, is those ones that have systemic arthritides that are inflammatory. So rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, juvenile idiopathic arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, et cetera. That contrast, the post-contrast sequences really show synovitis and inflammatory change, or have the potential to show that really well. So those are the patients where I get those. You know, the rheumatologists that most of us work with, if we do this, know this as well. But I think it's important to make sure that you communicate this, because same thing, radiologists and insurance companies, they'll say, well, why are you ordering it like this? This is a patient that has osteoarthritis. Why are you getting contrast? And the radiologists will either change the order or the insurance companies will deny it.
Got it. Okay. So you'll get that MRI, and then what on an MRI would tell you, okay, now you need further surgery?
Well, let's talk briefly about the Wilkes classification, because, you know, the Wilkes classification that we all know is not only a clinical classification, but you can use the imaging to help you determine what is going on. So for those of you who don't know, you know, Wilkes 1 and 2 is when we have disc displacement with reduction, and then with or without pain. When we get to 3, 4, and 5 is when we have worsening disease. So 3 is when we have disc displacement without reduction. When we're getting to 4, we're talking about degenerative changes of the bone. And then 5 is kind of end-stage disease where you have really bad degeneration, disc maceration, disc perforation, et cetera. On the MRI, you know, there's a bunch of different things you can see on the MRI. But let's again assume that you've already done an arthrocentesis and you're getting an MRI. One of the scenarios is that you see primarily soft tissue damage and that the bone looks pretty good. So you see cortical bone on the condyle and the fossa. Let's say you don't see much degeneration of the bone, maybe a little bit of chronic flattening of the condyle, but nothing concerning. And you see a disc that is still anteriorly displaced and it's maybe macerated or, you know, is degenerated in some way. At that point, you're probably talking about some type of soft tissue procedure, and all of us will have different opinions on how to do this. Some people will do arthroscopic repair of that if they think it's reasonable. Other people will do open repair of that as far as disc plications. You know, sometimes the disc is so damaged either that you can tell on the preoperative MRI or intraoperatively that you end up doing a discectomy as well. So that's kind of what I think of when you see severe soft tissue damage that was not responsive to arthrocentesis. Then you say, oh, that's why it wasn't responsive, because this disc was just totally destroyed. The other scenario is when you have a significant component of bony degeneration, which in my experience, if you have bony degeneration, you almost always have soft tissue discal degeneration too. And the bony degeneration, it depends upon the degree. And again, it also depends upon if we're talking about these inflammatory arthritis patients or just your normal osteoarthritis patient. But let's say that you get the MRI and there's significant erosive disease, either acute or chronic, where, you know, the condyle is flattened, you have severe bird beaking, you have osteophyte formation, maybe even have loose bodies in the joint. I think most of us, and, you know, I can't speak for people like, you know, Joe McCain and others that are so good at doing arthroscopic surgery, but most of us are thinking open procedures at this point. And really the two categories of open procedures are either open arthroplasty or open arthroplasty with joint replacement, if it is such so severe that we don't think we can adequately perform repair otherwise. Now, there are many other scenarios that come into play here on the MRI. If you are talking about patients that are dislocating and such. But if we're talking about limited mouth opening and pain, I'm kind of looking on the MRI if this is only soft tissue or if this is soft tissue with hard tissue damage as well.
Hey guys, I had a brief interruption to today's podcast. As many of you know, I'm a big fan of using a headlight. I feel like a headlight is so important to being able to distinguish what is what in the patient's mouth. I recently switched to the Spectra headlight that KLS Martin sells, and it's amazing. It's super bright and has a huge field. I highly recommend it. KLS Martin has been kind enough to give us a coupon code for extra batteries and a desktop charger for free with the purchase of the headlight. This is an amazing deal because the extra batteries are extremely helpful to have so that you have them readily charged as a backup option. If your batteries die, your current ones on your headlight, you can swap them out within a matter of seconds for fresh batteries and kind of go on with seeing what you need to see. So the coupon code is capital KLSPHL, all caps, and that's an acronym for KLS Portable Headlight, and it's good until mid-January 2023. So when you order the light through your area rep, just tell them the code and you can get that discount and get those free accessories that are, in my opinion, super important to this light and being able to use it flawlessly. I hope that helps and enjoy the rest of the episode. All right. So you have that kind of degenerated joint, lots of changes, bony changes. What tells you, hey, let's just go in there and take the disc out versus go in there and do arthroplasty?
So this is where you're probably going to get a lot of different opinions from different individuals. And I'll give you the way that I look into this. So first of all, it always comes back to a discussion with the patient. If someone tells you, I always do this surgery this way every single time based upon the MRI, and I don't have any discussion with the patient, well, I mean, clearly that's not the right way to do it, because there are some patients that are very adamant that they don't want open joint surgery. And there are some patients that are very adamant that they only want one surgery and they don't want to have to do multiple surgeries. And we just want to get it done and whatever it takes to do it. And that will push you too, one way or the other, as far as having a discussion on a more minor procedure or something as involved as a total joint replacement. So if I see that only soft tissue is involved, you're talking about discectomy versus more of an arthroplasty. Usually if I see that the degree of degeneration of the disc is pretty significant and the hard tissue disease is maybe mild or moderate, I personally will typically go to an open arthroplasty where I'll address the soft tissue disc, which if it's truly that degenerated may involve a discectomy. And you can perform a mild to moderate degree of open arthroplasty with recontouring. And I typically, too, at the same time, will perform eminectomies. And I usually do that because, you know, an eminectomy is a treatment for internal derangement. It has been in the past. It's not used that much anymore, as well as for dislocation. And in theory, particularly if patients already have significant disease, by doing an eminectomy, you can improve the translation and minimize the amount of difficulty in that afterwards postoperatively. Now, if patients have really, really severe degenerative disease before you go in, some people will still do open arthroplasties and try to recontour things. But I think more and more, as the total joint replacements have gotten better and the data for them are getting longer and longer, I think many people are having discussions with the patient saying, hey, we can do an open arthroplasty, you know, without a joint replacement, but very likely we're talking about doing a joint replacement very soon. And obviously minimizing the number of surgeries before a joint replacement is ideal. I mean, every study you've ever looked at, the more surgeries you have before a joint replacement, the more complications and infection risk with the joint replacement. So I think more and more people are having a lower threshold to, if there's moderate to severe bony changes, to talk about early on a discussion of a joint replacement versus other procedures. Although I'm sure there are other surgeons that would disagree with me on that.
Okay. As far as having success with the total joint replacement, this is a double question, but maybe first we can answer, what do you tell your patients afterward to do to have good success? And then the second question I'm sure most patients are going to ask you is, you know, how long can I expect this joint to last?
Yeah. So let me start as far as what success is by what the criteria are for a joint replacement. We actually don't still have criteria or guidelines for it in the US. The UK does as of 2008, and that's why what most of us talk about. So the UK National Institutes of Care Excellence, the NICE guidelines in 2008, basically said that if you're thinking about a joint replacement for a patient, they need to have a combination of factors, including but not limited to difficulty with eating. So they have to have a score of 5 or lower out of 10, as far as, you know, eating softer foods or liquids. They have to have pain, usually of 5 out of 10 or higher. They have to have quality of life issues. They have to have other changes in, let's say, occlusion or loss of vertical height, anterior open bite, et cetera. And then there are a couple other things that go into it too. But the idea is there have to be multiple factors that come into play. And so success then is the resolution of those. So pain goes down, what they're able to eat improves, maximum incisal opening improves above 35 millimeters, and quality of life improves. And obviously, if they had a dentofacial deformity due to condylar erosion, you correct that dentofacial deformity. So that's what we're looking at for success. And when I'm talking to a patient about what they should expect around the time of surgery, postoperatively, and then how long this joint's going to last, my protocol for these patients is when I do their joint replacements, we do our joint replacements, I keep them overnight and send them home in the morning. And that's partially because, I mean, you could send them home the same day, but it's partially because I want to do patient education with them when they're not acutely post-anesthetic. And, you know, many of our patients live hours and hours away. And so I will send them home, and I personally use hybrid arch bars with elastic traction for the first week or two. And I'll see them back at 1 or 2 weeks, take off the elastic traction and the arch bars in the office. And I will, at that time, 1 or 2 weeks out, have them start to aggressively use a Therabite for physical therapy. And I will counsel them on that. I will still have them have a relatively soft diet during that time, but I will tell them they can advance their diet if they're feeling well. And then I see them 1 month after that, so about 5 or 6 weeks total after the surgery, at which time I kind of assess how they've done with their physiotherapy. And if they've done well, I encourage them to continue that, but really release them from any restrictions and see them back in 2 or 3 months. As far as the longevity of the joints, I mean, I think the further along we get, the longer we're saying these joints work. And so our data currently is like 25 to 30 years at this point. It used to be 15 to 20, and then it was 20 to 25, and now it's getting even longer. So I tell young patients that they're probably going to have a repeat, or they could. So juvenile idiopathic arthritis patients, for example, that are unfortunately having a joint replacement at like age 30. But for my patients that are over age 50 or 60, I tell most of them that very likely the joint will last a lifetime from what we know so far. That being said, I mean, you reasonably counsel the patients on the risks of infection and hardware failure and all these other things.
Yeah, that's helpful to kind of go through each step of the phase there. It would be good to talk a little bit about some of the pathology, but one question, and I'm not sure there's a great answer to this, but
thanks.
I feel like in residency, a lot of us have this experience of we're kind of the dumping ground for all sorts of TMJ problems. There's just limited amount of providers who actually see these people. And I always kind of struggled with what is my role in treating these patients who really aren't surgical candidates. You get them in your chair and it's more myofascial or, you know, reducing clicking, but reducing, you know, because over the years I've come to say, hey, more and more, you know, this is not a surgical issue. I'm a surgeon. I do surgery. You are not a good candidate for surgery. You know, I can't really help you on the conservative aspect other than kind of referring you back to your dentist. I know a lot of surgeons do other things and are more involved in the conservative treatment. As an attending at Denver Health, they do more of that, you know, and sometimes it's a little frustrating because we see these patients over and over and over, and we're the ones prescribing the Flexeril and the anti-inflammatories and just kind of doing things that's not in our wheelhouse, you know, and we're kind of getting into a gray area of medicine that we don't really do. That's, for me, is more oral medicine. The sad part is there's just not many people who have experience in that. But how do you kind of parse that out and figure out, okay, how much do I help the non-surgical patient?
Yeah, this is a really good question, actually, because you're exactly right. So multiple answers to this. The first is that this is exactly why I limit the referrals that I see. Now, I have the luxury of doing that at an academic medical center. In the community, you may not be able to, but that's exactly why I make sure and I review every TMJ referral and all the records before I agree to see them, because I want to make sure that they've seen dental providers. I want to make sure that they're not going to waste, you know, a $350 consult to see me when I say, yeah, you don't need anything from me. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think making sure if you're seeing TMD patients, that your office, even before they see you, is very upfront with what you personally treat and what you don't treat. And so if you are someone that is happy to manage myofascial pain and you prescribe tricyclic antidepressants and you prescribe gabapentin and you are happy doing medication management with Voltaren gel and muscle relaxants and all these other things, great. But if you're someone that says, hey, unless you need arthrocentesis or something else, I'm not doing it, make sure that your office tells the patient, hey, Dr. Stuckey only does surgical management of temporomandibular joint disorders. We highly recommend before you see us that you see someone else. You know, you can even give them references, because if you do not need surgery, then, you know, there's nothing that we'll be doing for you. I hate when patients come in for a consult and it's really a waste of their time in addition to mine. And so I think that's really important. The next thing is, what do you do in the office when you are in that scenario? Because those scenarios still inevitably come up. When a patient's in your chair, you've done the examination, you've talked to them, you've maybe got a screening pano, or if you needed a CBC or something to rule out pathology or whatnot. And now you're in the scenario where, hey, there's nothing I as a surgeon need to do for you. And you have to be very, very cognizant of the patient, because, you know, you've spent a lot of time with them and now you're potentially going to tell them, I can't do anything for you to fix your problem. And the way I do this is, I usually try to be very thorough with them as far as what I found, what I didn't find. I still review everything on the imaging with them, even if it's completely normal. I say, you know, here's what I'm seeing on the condyle. I have models. I show them how the TMJ works. I try to make sure that they get a lot of information from the consult. And then the way I say it is like this. I say, listen, I have some really good news for you and I have some bad news for you. The really good news is, I don't think you're going to require any type of surgery for this. And most of them, I would say 90% of the patients are very relieved to hear that, truly. Only about 10% of them wanted me to say, I'm going to cut you open and fix your problem immediately. And I say the bad news that is the correlate to that is, I don't have a surgery that's going to fix your problem. And again, many of them are usually understanding to that. But then I talk about some of the other things that can be done. I have some sheets in my office that, even though I don't, again, do a lot of these conservative non-operative treatments, I have a sheet where I've outlined what the different options are by different providers. And I have a good discussion with them about what might be able to be done. And again, I'm lucky in my scenario that we have a couple of oral facial pain providers that are more than happy to take over. But even if you don't, I think it's really nice to have that discussion with the patient, make sure they feel they were involved and informed. And again, it's true. At the end of the day, it's good news that they don't need a surgical intervention to fix this problem. Even though, like I said, I always tell them the bad side of that is, I can't do one thing for you and make this go away.
Yeah. And I think one of the hard things about treating TMD, especially the non-surgical patient, is that what you said earlier is that there's usually multiple causes of this happening, you know? And so to fix it, you almost need, this day and age with so many people specializing, you almost need a team of specialists, like someone who's handling the jaw physical therapy, someone who's handling the mental aspect and reducing anxiety. It's just, and it seems like that is just so, that doesn't really exist. And it's very hard for patients to get that. And so, you know, as a surgeon, we sometimes feel that pressure of, well, maybe I will walk down this road of non-surgical treatment and try to help them, because there's really nobody out there who can. And we're just kind of swimming, you know, in some waters that we're not really familiar with, and treating, you know, prescribed medications that we don't really know or have much experience with. And so, I don't know. There's probably not a great answer to this. I'm just trying to give our listeners something to deal with to treat their patients safely.
Yeah, no, you're right, Grant. And the patients at Duke, I'm so lucky that I'm in an academic medical institution where we have all these specialists. You're exactly right. Many of these patients, they're seeing me, they're seeing our orofacial pain providers, they're seeing a physical therapist, a cognitive behavioral therapist, and a neurologist. And that's just to manage the TMD, because it's so multifactorial. You know, many times it's not possible in the community. And many times, even if it is possible, it may not be financially possible for the patient. So what happens a lot to me, and I'm sure this happens to other people as well, is I will see a patient. I will say, hey, good news, bad news. And then I'll say, but I'm going to send you to one of our orofacial pain providers. And then a few weeks later, they call back And they say, oh, you know, we contacted their office, but they don't take my insurance, so I'm going to come back and see you. And then it's really tricky because, well, I still don't treat your non-surgical TMD, but you want to see me because you can't see anybody else. And that's when you kind of have to set some boundaries.
Yeah.
And I many times, depending upon the situation, I may tell patients, listen, I'm okay making you an occlusal appliance through our office. I'm okay doing medication management with muscle relaxants and maybe a couple of things that I'm comfortable with. But if this is not effective for us, I cannot help you beyond this because we're going to be in territory where I'm not the right person to do it. And I'm so sorry that, you know, so-and-so wouldn't take your insurance, but that doesn't mean that I magically am able to do all the things that they can do safely.
Yeah. I like that response. That's really helpful to hear for sure. This could probably be a big rabbit hole, but at least that gives us some idea of how to think about the problem and how to help these patients. Maybe let's switch gears a little bit and just talk more about, you know, some of the pathology that can actually exist in the joint outside of just inflammation from adverse loading. What is some of the pathology, actual growths, you know, cysts, tumors, things that you can see in the joint?
Yeah, I like to have a short list, and I've always kind of thought of this as, quote, condyle lesions. Now, they don't always occur on the condyle, but the idea is that what pathology tends to show up in the TMJ. The short list is this, and really, I think two of them are the ones that I see all the time, and the other ones I hardly ever see. The short list is things like aneurysmal bone cysts, central giant cell granulomas, synovial chondromatosis, PVNS, which many people probably haven't heard of, pigmented villonodular synovitis, osteochondromas, osteoblastomas, and then if you want to throw in a malignancy, you can have osteo and chondrosarcomas. But probably the short list of what I see most commonly is synovial chondromatosis and then osteochondromas. So, you know, osteochondromas being benign tumorous growths of the condyle, since this is where we have cartilage and bone, and then synovial chondromatosis, which is a proliferative kind of metaplastic disorder of the synovium where, you know, we have all these what are called joint mice, these little free bodies that form within the joint space. Those two are the ones that I see most frequently. And I probably see one of those every month or two at this point. But the other ones are, you know, once in a blue moon that I see, at least in my practice.
Okay. Yeah, let's maybe talk about at least these more common ones. And maybe we could start with the synovial chondromatosis. How do you go about treating that?
Yeah, so synovial chondromatosis is a really interesting disease process. It was described by a guy named Milgram, who I think was at Northwestern, actually. And this process, again, it's a metaplastic process that goes in three phases. And so histopathologically, what happens is in the first phase, the synovium of the TMJ starts to undergo metaplasia. So it starts to go from synovium to forming this kind of chondroblastic type of tissue. And then as it continues to do this in the second phase, it sprouts off these little buds of cartilage and bone into the joint space. And this is where these free bodies or these joint mice form, as they're called. And this continues for a period of time. And then the process kind of burns itself out. It's self-limited. And the synovium actually goes back to normal. But now you've got all these cartilaginous or osteocartilaginous bodies within the joint. And obviously, this can cause problems if you got a bunch of rocks in your joint space. And so when I see these patients, either they present as normal TMD patients, and then on a screening panoramic, I see all this bone or multiple bodies in the joint space, or I've actually seen a significant number of patients that were not symptomatic at all, and they went to see a dentist, and the dentist establishing care with them got a screening panoramic and found this. And so these patients have, again, this metaplastic process. And, you know, the way I treat this, it depends upon where they are in the disease process, which sometimes you don't know. So if they're in the earlier phases and the synovium is still active, in theory, you have to remove the synovium too, what's been called a radical synovectomy when you remove these cartilaginous or osteocartilaginous nodules. But many of the patients that I have seen recently, for one reason or another, are patients that they're in that last phase, the quiescent phase. And I see panoramics from like years and years ago, and it looks exactly the same, or a CBCT from 2 years apart, and it looks exactly the same. And in those patients, what I do is I actually go in and remove the nodules and I look at the synovium. And if it looks normal, I leave it and then I close everything up. And so these patients usually can be treated symptomatically in that fashion. Now, if a patient wasn't symptomatic and this was instantly found, you wouldn't have to do anything about it. I mean, to my knowledge, unless there's something I'm unaware of, there's no likelihood of this converting into some other sinister process. But usually these patients are symptomatic.
Okay. And then for the osteochondroma, how do you treat that?
Yes. So the osteochondroma is probably the most frequent one I see. This is a slow growing process of the condyle. And so, when these patients present, many times they present with a slowly developing malocclusion. And it will almost look as if they're having condylar hyperplasia, but obviously it's not condylar hyperplasia because they're not in the growth phase. They're not an adolescent. They're 50, 60, and all of a sudden they're developing a posterior unilateral open bite. And when you get imaging, you'll see that one of the condyles, although it can occur in the glenoid fossa, I have seen it multiple times arise from the glenoid fossa instead of the condyle, you will see this growth of, and it usually looks kind of a mixture of osteosclerotic and radiolucent appearance. That's a bulbous growth coming from within the joint space. You can almost be guaranteed that it's going to be an osteochondroma if that's what you see. I never biopsy them beforehand. I mean, it's difficult to do that. Theoretically, could it be a chondrosarcoma? It could be. Again, that is so rare. And in fact, you many times can't even diagnose that until you excise it anyway, that these are typically treated as osteochondromas. Now, there are a few different ways to treat these, and it depends upon where the osteochondroma is located. If it's kind of budding off the condyle or budding off the glenoid fossa, and you have pretty good normal bone stock next to it, you can go in and just excise, resect the osteochondroma, and then recontour the glenoid fossa and the condyle, kind of like an arthroplasty, and put things back together. If it's really destroyed the condyle, if most of the condyle is involved by this, you may be talking about essentially a total joint replacement, where you're essentially resecting off the condyle and doing a replacement. I've seen it both ways. I'm sure other people have as well. You know, again, these are slow growing processes. And so you're not necessarily worried about this causing a greater problem in the short term. And so in theory too, if this occurred in a very, very old individual and they weren't symptomatic and they didn't care about their slowly developing malocclusion, you could just monitor it as well. But typically this is occurring in a scenario where you need to resect the area of this benign pathology with or without a joint reconstruction.
Okay. And if you resect and contour that, you're not doing the total joint, what's the likelihood of that reoccurring?
It's relatively low, but it depends upon the extent. I mean, I have had ones that are pretty small when they're caught, and the likelihood of those recurring is quite low. I've also had ones that are huge that people just totally neglected. And to the extent that, like, it's wrapping around the medial side of the skull base from the glenoid fossa and everything. And I mean, I guarantee you, I'm leaving some tissue behind because it's up next to the foramen in the skull base. And those, yeah, you're going to be monitoring it with imaging. But again, it's a very, very slow growing process. And in those cases, they're usually older individuals as well. And they've been, basically neglecting this for a decade or more. We're having a conversation saying, hey, we're doing this because you're not functioning well. This is, more than just a go in and resect something that's a couple centimeters and be done. And monitoring that clinically and radiographically is usually acceptable, in my opinion. But most of them are caught at a reasonable time course where you can resect it, you know where your margins are, and you're just monitoring that and expecting a low rate of recurrence.
Got it. Okay. And then after these two, what are some of the others that you're commonly seeing? Is it the aneurysmal bone cyst, the giant cell lesion, or what do you see?
Yeah, it's those two. It's those two. It's the ABCs and the giant cells. And again, those are still quite uncommon in this scenario. The interesting one that I would recommend listeners look into, even though it's super uncommon, is the PVNS. I mean, it's just a very interesting process. It's similar to synovial chondromatosis, in that is that it is a synovial process, but the synovium is basically undergoing this like tumorous transformation. And even though there are not many good reports on PVNS, there's a number of them with this, you know, proliferating through the glenoid fossa into the middle cranial fossa. And so those cases can become quite problematic as far as treating, at least in the literature, because many times it's difficult to do a complete excision of them. Many times these patients will actually get postoperative radiotherapy to try to slow the growth of this, even though it's not a malignancy. But I have only myself seen one case of PVNS. And I think of those reported in the literature, there's less than 100. Granted, there's plenty more that aren't reported, but that is a very infrequent but very interesting disease process to be aware of.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that's a real helpful kind of run through of these things. As far as, you know, for a board exam, I don't recall getting much in the way of like an advanced pathology, but what would your kind of 2 cents be for those preparing for the oral board, potentially getting questions about some of this stuff?
I think if you're preparing for TMJ disorders, a couple of things to conceptualize this. So one is absolutely know your examination for the TMJ and absolutely know some of those HPI questions for the TMJ, particularly history of trauma, history of psychiatric and stress factors, and history of inflammatory arthritides, juvenile idiopathic arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, etc. I absolutely got a question just about those things on my boards. Secondly, I think make sure you know what you're talking about by, in general, splitting TMJ disorders into myofascial type of things and, you know, intracapsular type of problems. And it's not as easy as just those two, but there are absolutely different modes of treatment for patients that have myofascial pain and patients that have true intracapsular problems. And then I think the next step for me, when I like to think about these, is this a hypomobility problem or a hypermobility problem? So hypomobility problems are things like internal derangement, disc displacement, but also things like fibrous and bony ankylosis. And then hypermobility problems are things like subluxation, dislocation, open lock, and things like that. And those are treated differently. Hypomobility problems, we're usually functioning within the joint, either arthrocentesis, we're doing something with the disc, or we're having to reconstruct the joint if it's all the way to ankylosis and end-stage joint disease. Whereas hypermobility problems, many times we're not doing anything with the disc or the condyle, but we may be doing things like an eminectomy or a procedure to block the eminence. You can inject things like autologous blood injections, which we didn't really get into because there's so many things to talk about. But there's two different paths for someone that's having hypomobility versus hypermobility. And then I think the last thing just for individuals moving forward with boards is you don't have to know actually how to do every single TMJ procedure, but make sure you know the things that you have done and make sure you know options. And when an examiner asks you, how would you treat this? Just tell them how you would treat it. I mean, if you don't do level 2 arthroscopy and do, you know, disc plication arthroscopically, you don't have to describe that during your boards. But if you do know how to do an open discectomy and you've been involved in that before, then describe that. And so I think those are my tips. I mean, you get into trouble when you start to talk about things that you've never done before and you're not aware of. And so stick with the things that you know are standard treatments and that you can describe well, even if, you know, there's something else that could be described for a board answer too.
Oh, yes. I love that. That's great. Great advice. That served me well as well when I was on my board, is to stick with what I know and say, hey, you know, I would potentially do this or that, or if this kind of outside of my wheelhouse, refer. And then they may ask you, well, what do you think that person would do? Well, here's what I think they would do. You know, I don't know, do that disc plication, for example, procedure myself. And so I can't describe that, but this seems to be like it would be a good candidate for that, blah, blah, blah. And you could kind of talk about that.
I think one last point, just because this was funny to me, is if you're confident with something, go ahead and answer it. And sometimes the board examiners will try to trick you, or they'll ask you, why are you doing that? Because maybe they don't even know what you know, right? I mean, you're fresh out of residency. You may have been working with someone that does these things. And just because the board examiner is saying, well, really, why would you do that? I've never heard of that before. If you have done it, or if you know it's a thing, confidently answer and move on. And don't be second guessed by the questions if you're confident in your initial answer.
Yep, totally agree. All right, Ben, I really appreciate you taking the time to run through some of the stuff. Certainly, we haven't covered everything that can happen in TMD or pathology, but I think this has been a good foundation. I assume, like you said in other podcasts, if there are listeners that have further questions or cases they want to run by you, Are you okay fielding questions about this?
Absolutely. I'm just sitting at my computer here waiting to hear from everybody. So just email me at any time.
Awesome. Thank you so much. All right. Let's keep in touch and do another episode soon.
Sounds good, Grant. Have a good night.
You too. I'll talk to you later. Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Once again, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, guests you'd like to hear from, or if you yourself would love to be a guest, please, please email me or text me at 720-441-6059. And also just love hearing from people. If you enjoy the podcast or, you know, learn something from it or talk to a friend or connected with someone because of the podcast, that just makes my day. So please shoot that correspondence over to me and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you.